that means that we're now in the final chapter, not only the final chapter of the unit, but the final chapter of the course. And this one takes a look at things at the chromosomal level. We had an earlier chapter called the molecular basis of inheritance. Now this one is the chromosomal basis of inheritance. So we're looking at not so much at the from the viewpoint of an allele, but from the viewpoint of a chromosome on which it contains many alleles. And in the opening chapter, the opening slide, we're revisiting a cross that we looked at before. What kind of cross is this? We've looked at this same cross before.
Dihybrid?
Right, this is a dihybrid cross. Di indicates that we're paying attention to two rather than just one characteristic. What are the characteristics here? Seed color and seed shape, exactly. Doesn't mean they have anything to do with each other. We're just choosing to pay attention to both of them rather than just one of them. And it's a hybrid cross because one parent is different in its traits for that characteristic compared to the other. So yellow, round-seeded, that's a true breeder, so it's a double homozygous dominant. That's why it's upper, upper Y, upper, upper R, crossed with a double homozygous recessive, upper, lower, lower Y, lower, lower R, green wrinkled. That's not new. We've looked at that before. What is new is that we're drawing pictures with chromosomes. Now, these cells don't necessarily have four chromosomes in them total. It's just that we're not paying attention to any other characteristics except for seed color and seed shape, right? So the only chromosomes we care about are the ones that have the gene for color, the locus of the gene for color, and the locus for the gene for texture. In other words, we don't know what N is. We're only caring about these particular chromosomes. But it is two different chromosomes that these two genes we're looking at appear on, which doesn't have to be the case, by the way, right? We could have two genes that are on the same chromosome, but these ones are on separate chromosomes. And so, of course, you have four involved chromosomes in each of the diploids, because diploids have two homologous chromosomes of each type. All right. The black marks are simply represent where the gene is located on that respective chromosome. So the black position is the locus for each gene. When you have each of these parents undergo meiosis in order to produce gametes, which is the only hope you have for crossing the two, meiosis individually chooses one or the other of the homologs. But it does that for each of the two types of chromosomes. So since these are true breeders, it doesn't matter really which ones are chosen. It's just a rehashing of what we said before, but with chromosome pictures to go along with it. But the point here is that each parent, original parent here, can make only one kind of gamete with respect to seed color and seed shape. So haploid gametes produce diploid zygotes in the F1, and now you see the chromosomes involved here. Each one has an upper or dominant seed color and a recessive seed color allele, and each one has a dominant seed shape and a recessive seed shape allele. That's why all the F1s are alike. They all have the same genotype, upper, lower Y, upper, lower R. And then we get to the two text boxes here. When the F2s get to be produced here, it really explains it better in the F2. But you can see here that we have two laws. These are laws Mendel came up with. So the so-called law of segregation and the so-called law of independent assortment. Well, Mendel was right about this, as I said before about Mendel. He had no idea about a chromosome or DNA, but he was right about what was happening. So these laws are still on the books, so to speak. They really just describe things that are happening in meiosis, things that we've already studied. And in fact, the law of independent assortment is named after something we've already studied by name, independent assortment, right? So that happens in meiosis. When does that happen specifically in meiosis? When does independent assortment occur? What part of meiosis? Well, I was assuming that you were already familiar with independent assortment. Maybe we should review that. What does it mean, the phrase? Right, that's what assortment by itself refers to. Assortment refers to how a tetrad positions itself at the metaphase plate, halfway between the poles. Either red up, blue down, or blue up, red down. Those are the two possibilities in the cartoon scheme. That's assortment by itself. What does independent assortment mean?
Like resets for every tetrad.
That's right. How one tetrad lines up is not at all affected or dependent on how other tetrads line up. Each tetrad has its own coin to flip. It's not one coin flip for the entire cell. If that were true, then it would be all blues up and all reds down, or all reds up and all blues down. Instead, there are N coins being flipped because there are N tetrads, N types of chromosomes, right? So that's what law of independent assortment refers to. That happens. The answer to my original question is that it happens at metaphase. That's when the lining up occurs. That's when the assortment occurs. And how many possibilities are there in general for independent assortment for any given species? Correct. That's the general formula. 2 to the n minus 1, which means one possibility only for an n of 1, 2 for an n of 2, 4 for an n of 3, and so on. Doubles every time you add a different type of chromosome. All right, the law of segregation, as you see, says that the two alleles for each gene, for each single gene, separate during gamete formation. Well, that is true. But what you should keep in mind, especially given these pictures, I mean, that's what the pictures are really good about here, is that the alleles, while they do separate from each other, the alleles are not individual entities acting on their own, right? The alleles are like passengers on a boat. And so whatever boat they're on, all the passengers on that same boat go to the same place, right? In other words, the nucleus doesn't have a bunch of individual pieces of DNA called alleles. Each allele is just part of a chromosome. But there are two homologs of a chromosome in a diploid, and those are what separate. The homologs separate when in meiosis? In anaphase 1, yes. Anaphase is separation in general, right? But when the homologs separate, specifically anaphase 1. Anaphase 2 separates chromatids, but that happens later. But anyway, this explains Mendel's law of segregation. And so this is why, because of both of these, this is why all four possible combinations of these four traits in two characteristics are possible in the F2. In other words, we can have both yellow and round, we can have green and round, we can have yellow and wrinkled, and we can have green and wrinkled. In the familiar 9:3:3 ratio, as we've talked about. Okay, slide 2 shows you close-ups of some fruit fly eyes. These are species in a fruit fly genus called, Drosophila. I'm trying to write this in italics, as it's supposed to be, since it's a genus name. But Drosophila are fruit flies, and they are used for a lot of genetics experiments. They are a model species, model organism, for various reasons. Model organisms are things that are ideally suited for certain types of experiments for various reasons. But one thing that's nice about fruit flies is that, or a couple things that are nice about fruit flies, is that they're really easy to maintain. You don't really have to try very hard to have fruit flies. In fact, all you need to do is leave your bananas in your kitchen for a couple hours and you'll have a lot of fruit flies if you have doors open. But they are easy to keep in the lab. They don't easily die. But genetically speaking, a really important thing about them is that they have a quick life cycle. So 1 week is a generation. And therefore, within a year, you can go through 50 generations, which, if you're using humans, even if you were allowed to use them as an experiment, 50 generations would take many lifetimes, right? But generations are important in genetics, as we've talked about, the F1 to the F2 and so on. So they're studied for all kinds of different reasons in genetics, but what we're looking at here in these fruit flies specifically is one characteristic again. This one happens to be eye color, though. And we're looking at two specific eye colors, two traits of eye colors. This reddish one is the so-called wild type. And I'll just remind you what wild type means. I've given you that definition already. But the wild type is the type encountered most often in natural populations. And fruit flies are pretty small, but they're not so small that you can't just see them with the naked eye. If you really pay attention to a fruit fly in your house, you can see that most of them have red eyes. All right. White eyes are a mutant form, a mutant trait, caused by a mutant allele versus the wild type allele, which is for red. And red happens to be dominant over white, although it's not always true that the wild type is the dominant. It's possible for the wild type to be a recessive trait. It's just not in this case. That's what we're looking at. Let's go to 3 and see what's happening here. I need to... I'll explain that in a minute. It looks, in this case, like this is just another Mendelian example. But it's not. But the reason it looks like it is that we have one characteristic with two traits, red and white, and the parents differ in their traits, so it looks like a regular monohybrid cross, right? And it continues to look like that because I told you that red is dominant over white. So what you would expect in the Mendelian case is for the F1 generation all to have the dominant trait, and they do. Red eyes. And it even looks like in the F2 we have the expected ratio. Because you would expect, just like for the pea plant flower color, you expect the F2 generation to have a 3-to-1 ratio of dominant to recessive. And you have that here, 3 reds to 1 white. But this is not a Mendelian case, and this is not like the pea plant flower color. What is it? you just look at everything above the conclusion box, what is it that we have here listed that we didn't care about before? Right. We never said which parent was the male and which parent was the female. And that's not because they're plants. Plants have males and females too, right? We just didn't care in those examples because it didn't matter at all. Here we're looking at a case in which it does matter. And this is why it's not a Mendelian case. All right? So I need to give you a couple definitions, as I so often do. Think back to the karyotype that we looked at, which was a human karyotype. Just as an example, we used the humans. We had how many different kinds of chromosomes in that human karyotype example? Right, humans have an N of 23, so there's 23 different kinds, and that's why they were arranged in 23 groups. They were 23 pairs because human adults are diploid. But I don't have the picture up or I would show you again. Remember, they were numbered by size. So the biggest pair is number one. Next to biggest is number two and so on. But if you remember, there was no 23. There was a 23rd pair, but it wasn't listed as number 23. It was listed as XY. And that's because that individual happened to be a male human that we were looking at that karyotype for. But the point here is that in many animal species, including humans and including fruit flies, there are two categories of chromosomes. And categories is different from types. The two major categories of chromosomes in sexual species are autosomes and sex chromosomes. What does auto mean? Auto means self. So autosome gets its name because these are chromosomes that are really just about that organism's self. Sex chromosomes are so called because even though they do more than this, they are involved in determining the sex of offspring, if any offspring are produced. Okay? Autosomes don't do that, but sex chromosomes do. So these two categories, there can be just different numbers of them depending on the species. And in the human karyotype example, there's N is 23. There's 23 overall types of chromosomes. 22 of them are autosomes, and there's one type of sex chromosome. Okay? Now, that's one pair of definitions. Another definition is sex-linked. We can use this phrase to describe either a gene or a characteristic. A characteristic, remember, corresponds to a gene. But what the meaning of sex-linked is simply that gene, a sex-linked gene, is simply a gene that resides on a sex chromosome for that species. Any given gene is obviously going to be on a chromosome somewhere. So for humans, it's a much greater chance that a randomly chosen gene is going to be an autosomal gene, meaning a gene found on one of the autosomes. But there are some genes that are on the X chromosome and the Y chromosome, and those are called sex-linked genes. Now, I really wish I had put the karyotype picture up there because, well, I have another picture coming up. The reason this matters, whether a gene is autosomal or sex-linked, is that autosomes are, a pair of autosomes, homologous pair as they're called, are truly homologous, meaning they're not only the same type of chromosome, but they have the same number of genes. They really correspond to each other. Now, the genes, the alleles for those genes aren't necessarily the same in the two homologs as we've been talking about, right? But each of the two versions of the number three, for example, have the same number of genes. That's not necessarily true for sex chromosomes, though. Or it's not in general true. Meaning that one version of the sex chromosome can have drastically different number of overall genes compared to the other version of the sex chromosome. And that's true for humans, and it's true for fruit flies. The X chromosome is much bigger in both of these two species, humans and fruit flies. The X chromosome is much bigger than the Y chromosome, even though they're both the same type of chromosome. They're both a sex chromosome. Since the X is much bigger than the Y, that means the X chromosome has a lot more genes on it than the Y chromosome, which in turn means that the X chromosome has genes that the Y chromosome doesn't even have. Okay? Now, we talked about different categories of individuals with respect to their genotypes. What three major categories am I talking about? Three phrases that describe genotypes or individuals. Right. Exactly. All three of those terms make perfect sense for any autosomal gene. Because for autosomal genes, the diploid has two of the chromosomes, and each of which has the same number of genes, and therefore it doesn't matter which gene you're talking about on an autosome, a diploid individual has two alleles for that gene. But that's not true for a sex chromosome. An X chromosome has some genes that just don't exist on the Y chromosome. Okay? And this is why the sex of the individual matters. And we happen to use the same sex determination mechanism that fruit flies do, as far as chromosomes are concerned. Meaning that two X's makes the individual a female. One X and one Y makes the individual a male. All right? Well, for a female who is XX, that really is pretty much the same situation as for an autosome, because she has two alleles for all of those genes that are carried by X, since she has two X chromosomes. But a male has only one X and a Y, and therefore, for any gene that appears on the X only, but not on the Y, the male only has one allele for that gene. And therefore, we wouldn't use any of those terms, of those three terms you mentioned, to describe a male. If we were talking about a sex-linked gene, we could use those terms for autosomal genes, but not for a sex-linked gene. It wouldn't make sense to call a male homozygous, either dominant or recessive, because homozygous means both alleles are the same. Well, he doesn't have two alleles, so you can't talk about both of them. And heterozygous means the two are different. He doesn't have two. So we use a different word for a male, which is hemizygous. Now, this word is only used if we're describing a sex-linked gene. It doesn't describe the entire individual. Okay? Hemi means half, though. So he has half as many alleles compared to a female. That's why the word was invented. Okay, so what looks like a Mendelian thing, just because the ratios happen to be the same, is really quite different. And we can see that after the word conclusion here. If we pay attention not only to the sex of each individual, but to the chromosomes that are carrying the gene we care about, which is the eye color gene. So eye color has nothing to do with sex determination. The sex chromosomes determine the sex, but that's not the only thing they do. There's genes that happen to just be on that chromosome as well. It has nothing to do with determining sex, including eye color. So we have here a female. This is the female symbol. This is the male symbol, if you don't already know that. So the mother here in the P generation is wild type. She's not only wild type, she is, and therefore red-eyed, she is homozygous. So this is yet another standard for genotypes. W here actually means white, which is the recessive allele. Usually we use a letter denoting the dominant one, but here we use recessive. But if we have a plus superscript, that actually means it's the wild type instead, which is red. So W super plus means red. W by itself means white. She is homozygous red-eyed, though. Homozygous dominant. Well, he is not homozygous anything. He's hemizygous for this gene because he is XY. That's what makes him male. And the Y chromosome doesn't have an allele for the W gene. Only the X one does. And the one allele that he has for eye color happens to be the white version. Notice that in a hemizygous individual, dominance doesn't matter. It's the one allele that you have that determines your eye color. So having just one white is enough for him. It's the only allele he has. Therefore, he's white-eyed. Okay, now in this Punnett square, it should make sense to you, because it's really the same as other examples, that this homozygous dominant female can make only one kind of egg with respect to eye color. It doesn't matter which of these chromosomes gets chosen by meiosis. Right? So there's only one row in this Punnett square because there's only one possible egg. But he's a hemizygous individual, so meiosis can choose the X or the Y. You can make two different kinds of sperm. One with an X chromosome that he's going to donate, or one with a Y chromosome he's going to donate. And then as usual, you match up egg with sperm to make the zygotes in the boxes of the Punnett square. But unlike the other cases, the autosomal cases, not only does this indicate the actual genotypes and phenotypes with respect to the characteristic we're looking at, but it also determines the sex of the offspring, because these are sex chromosomes that it's on, right? So if you use a X chromosome from the father, and an egg has to be X because it came from an XX mother, then that's going to make an XX and therefore female offspring. So all the females will be red-eyed in the F1, and they'll all be heterozygous because they have one X with a red, one X with a white. Okay? So that agrees with all the F1s having red eyes so far. If the Y sperm is chosen instead for fertilization and it gets together with the X egg, that's going to make an XY individual, and that makes males instead. But the X in a male in the XY system, fruit flies and us, has to have come from the mother. The only way you can get a Y is from your father. So the X came from the true breeding red mother, and therefore all of the males are also red-eyed, but they're red-eyed hemizygous. Still, though, that means all the F1s are red-eyed, just for a different reason. Now you get the F1s together to make the F2. Well, since you have a heterozygous female in the F1, she's able to make either a red egg or a white egg. And a hemizygous male, of course, can make two kinds of sperm, an X and a Y. But the X here is going to be carrying the red allele. And therefore, you have this 3-to-1 ratio, but it's for a totally different reason. It's not a 3-to-1 ratio irrespective of sex. It was for flower color. It was 3 purples to 1 white without caring about sex. Right? So it really would have meant if you had 1,000 individual offspring in the flower colors, you would expect 500 to be males and 500 to be females because it's an even chance. But 3/4 of those males should be purple, 1/4 should be white. 3/4 of the females should be purple, 1/4 should be white. Not what we're seeing here, though, at all. What this says is that every female should be red-eyed because red is dominant over white. Half of the females should be homozygous dominant. Half should be heterozygous. But phenotypically, all of the females should be red. That's what this means. Both possible types of females are red-eyed. This says that half of the males should be white-eyed and the other half should be red. And that's shown here. Okay, so yes, overall it's 3-to-1 because you make as many males as females, but it's impossible for a female to be white-eyed here in the F2. That's a sex-linked trait or sex-linked gene or sex-linked characteristic. Okay, slide 4 is just a picture of X and Y chromosomes to show you there is quite a bit of a difference in size. Actually, these ones are human cells. Not, there's XY chromosomes in fruit flies as well, but they don't. This one has to be a human photograph. X is much bigger than Y, though, so there are a lot of genes that are on the X only and not also on the Y. Any of those that are on X only and not Y are sex-linked genes. Now, technically speaking, the others are sex-linked as well, but if there are any genes that are on the X and also on the Y, they're not really going to act like they're sex-linked because there's 2 versions of them, so it'll be just like the autosomal case. All right, slide 5. Now, this is not at all an exhaustive listing of sex determination mechanisms. Not even close. I mean, there's all kinds of sex determination mechanisms that different species use. This is, first of all, obviously incomplete because we're only looking at one group of organisms, the animals. There's all kinds of other sexual species, right? They have different sex determination mechanisms not shown here. But this also is not complete even for animals. It's just giving you some interesting examples. Starting with the human example, which is the XY system that you're most familiar with probably. And when you look at the parents here, the male is listed as 44 plus XY. What does 44 here refer to? Right. The 22 pairs of autosomes multiply to 44, right? So there's 22 pairs of autosomes because N is 23 and there's only one sex chromosome type. Similarly for the female, except she's 44 plus XX, he's 44 plus XY. The sex chromosomes determine the sex. And so in humans and some other species of animals, like the fruit flies we just looked at, any animal that uses the XY system, it's the male that has 2 different kinds of sex chromosomes, 1X and 1Y. And it's the female that has 2 of the same type, 2Xs. All right. Now, because of this, males in the XY system are the ones that determine the sex of the offspring. And that's because a female has only X chromosomes to give to the zygote if fertilization occurs. In other words, she can make only one kind of egg with respect to sex chromosomes. It's going to meiosis is randomly going to choose one of her X chromosomes or the other. But every egg she makes is going to have an X chromosome. That's why the haploid genotype here for the egg is 22 plus X. But males have an X chromosome and a Y chromosome, so meiosis can randomly choose either of those. He can therefore make two kinds of gametes, two kinds of sperm with respect to sex chromosomes. A 22 plus X, if it chooses the X chromosome, or a 22 plus Y. Well, he determines the sex of the offspring because she's giving an X no matter what. He's giving either an X or a Y, and therefore he determines whether it's going to be XX, a girl, or XY, a boy. So that one should probably already be familiar to you. Let's go to this next one in B, which is, it's called, and it looks like the XO system, but it's really a zero, X0 system. It's fine to call it the XO system, though. This is used, for instance, in grasshoppers, as you see. And the reason it's the zero, which is nothing, of course, is that there aren't two versions of the sex chromosome in this species, or species that use it. There's only X chromosomes. How many autosomes are there in this grasshopper species? How many autosomes? It is diploid.
11 pairs.
Right, there's 11 autosomes, 11 types, two of each of them. So it's 22 plus either XX or 22 plus X. There's only one kind of sex chromosome, but how many the individual has determines the sex. So females are XX, just like they are for us. Males are not XY. There is no Y version. Males have just a single X. Next is the ZW system, which is most birds. We talked about this already in the lab, right? Because we studied the DNA of birds, owls. The ZW works exactly like the XY system that we use, except it's reversed with respect to who determines the sex of the offspring. Because it's reversed with respect to which sex has two of the same kind and which sex has one of each of the two kinds. And they're also different names, of course. They have no X or Y. They have a Z possibility and a W possibility. But having one of each, a ZW, makes that individual female, not male. So that's why it's kind of the opposite from our viewpoint. Having two Zs makes a male. So in the ZW system, birds, it's the female that determines the sex of the offspring because she's the one that can make two different kinds of gametes with respect to sex chromosomes. She can make a Z egg or a W egg, whereas he can make only a Z sperm. The most interesting one from our viewpoint is the bottom one. Well, at least it's the most interesting to me. It's the weirdest one from our point of view. The so-called haplodiploid system, which is seen in certain social insects like bees. In the haplodiploid system, there are no sex chromosomes. It's only autosomes. And what determines the sex, since there are no sex chromosomes, is the ploidy of the individual. A diploid individual is a female. They happen to have 16 kinds of autosomes. So 32 in a diploid individual overall chromosomes, and that will be a female. A haploid individual is a male. Okay, now this, there's several weirdnesses about this compared to humans, at least. It's perfectly normal for them, of course. One bit of weirdness, though, is that unlike humans, female bees can reproduce without mating. Now, females in general lay eggs, right? Including humans. But an egg by itself, in most sexual species, just dies as an egg, after however much time, unless it's fertilized by a sperm. Not true with bees, though. In bees, a female's eggs can actually develop into an adult without being fertilized. Just like in us, the egg is haploid. But if it is not fertilized, that egg will continue to be haploid. It will just undergo meiosis to become multicellular. That'll be an adult haploid, which is by definition a male. So that means a female can make male bees simply by laying eggs and not mating. She'll have all sons. If she does mate, then her eggs will be fertilized, which will make diploid zygotes, which by definition will be females. So she can either not mate and have sons, or she can mate and have daughters. Another bit of weirdness here is that because of how this works, a male bee has no father, right? Because the only way to become haploid, and therefore male, is for your mother to not mate, to not have a father, to just lay eggs and have the eggs develop into you. So if a male bee does not have a father. A male bee also cannot have sons. Because if a male bee does mate, that's going to produce diploid offspring, which by definition are females. Plus, even though a male bee doesn't have a father or can't have sons, a male bee does have a grandfather, and it can have grandsons. Right? Because a male bee has a mother, and that mother had to have a father because she is diploid. The only way you can make a diploid is by mating. So his mother's father is his grandfather, even though he doesn't have a father. And similarly, he can have grandsons because if he makes daughters, she can lay eggs without mating and develop into sons, which would be his grandsons. So pretty wild from our point of view, but it's just another thing that evolved and worked. I think that's probably, well, I have a little bit of time left, but that's a good place to stop. I'll finish it up next time.